Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, we're talking with Lynn DeMittle about her book, The Second Line of Defense, American Women and World War I. Lynn, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark. I'm really pleased to be here.
And we're pleased to have you. I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Sure. I'm a U.S. historian. I've spent most of my academic life in California, and I'm just recently retired from Occidental College in Los Angeles, where I taught modern U.S. history. And my interests are the 20th century cultural history, politics, and women's history as well.
And this book does seem to be a great, venue for you in that respect, because it's you bring all of those elements into play in it.
Exactly.
How was it that you came to write this book?
Well, you know, I sometimes make up stories because I worked on it for so long, I'm not sure I remember the origins. You know, I mean, it's at least 10 years. But I think, you know, I've been thinking a little bit about it, and I think some of it has to do with the confluence of essentially two projects. My last big book was a book on the 1920s called The Modern Temper, which is a sort of cultural social history of the decade of the 20s. And then after I wrote that, I did some textbook work, including a text called Through Women's Eyes in American History with Documents, which I co-authored with Ellen Du Bois. And that book brought me into really developing the second field of women's history, which I had been teaching but hadn't been writing about. And so I had now sort of two fields. And as I was writing material for the women's history book, I started thinking more and more about questions I hadn't answered in The Modern Temper about World War I, and specifically about women in World War I, because one of the things about the 20s is people kept saying at the time, since the war, something happened, like the war became a marker. And in particular, one of the arguments was, since the war, there's been a new woman. And I felt I hadn't really gotten a handle on that when I wrote the 20s book. And so I pushed back into World War I in a kind of exploratory way and ended up with a book after 10 years of, you know, exploring it.
I have to say the timing of the book couldn't be better. And one of the things I really enjoyed when I read it was how you explore those questions, but you also are capturing how they addressed a moment outside of the context of what happened afterward.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Thank you. I'm glad you saw that. There is a sort of difference between the experience of the war and the way it's remembered. And I tried to make a difference, show the difference between those two.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling us something about what life was like for women in America prior to war, because one of the things you do in the book is you talk about how the developments that were taking place in America, especially for women in the years leading up to World War I, played a role in terms of shaping their experiences and their responses to the war.
Sure. And I'm really glad you asked me that question, because one of the things I like most about my book is that it gave me the opportunity to write fairly extensively about the pre-war era, the sort of, I guess we would call them the teens, right? And it was a period of extraordinary ferment for American women, even though, you know, the 20s often is considered to be the time that women experience a lot of social and cultural change. It's really the teens where it gets started. So, for example, participation of women in the workforce takes a big tick up in 1910, and including something that will become very important in the 1920s, women start becoming much more engaged in clerical work. So there's an increase in the participation of women in the workforce. It's all in a, what we would call a sex-segregated labor market, in that they were primarily doing jobs that were considered women's work. So that's the sort of work side of the pre-war era. The other thing that's really interesting about the teens, of course, is this is the suffrage movement really heats up in this era. And by World War I, 11 states had already given women the suffrage. So there is this kind of real momentum to keep working to make that enfranchisement complete. So there's a lot of activity, a lot of engagement in that. And the other thing that I find interesting about the pre-war era is women were so involved in the progressive reform era, trying to address the sort of social and political inequalities of the period. And although for the most part not enfranchised, they used their persuasive powers and the powers of organizations to, on the state level, to get a lot of state laws passed, particularly those connected to protecting women and protecting children. And this includes, although the vast majority of the women reformers are sort of white, middle class, or elite women, this also includes African American women, whose participation in the National Association of Colored Women really advances in this era as well. And so going into the war, there is a network of engaged women eager to find a political voice, eager to make changes in American life and to improve women's status. And so the war intersects with this dramatic and very momentous period for American women.
You just had this phrase for it in the book, and you talk about how they're occupying public spaces, and they're doing this with marches, they're doing this with demonstrations, and it's a level of public engagement or public demonstration that has really not been seen until relatively recently. Yes, women, you know, marched for decades, but the level of it and the scope of the range does seem to be much larger. And then as you just said, it feeds directly into the war itself.
Yeah. And, you know, when I was doing the Women's March in January, I thought a lot about the notion of women participating in public space and also doing so in the context of a presidential inauguration, because one of the big pre-war marches for women was the suffrage parade in Washington, D.C. on the day after, I think it's after, I may be wrong, I'm having a little brain freeze, but when Woodrow Wilson was elected president. And so one of the things that was interesting about that march is the women are set upon by thugs. They're roughed up a bit and the police don't really intervene because it's not respectable for women to be in public in that way. It's really considered pretty transgressive. And so one of the things I like about what I'm able to do, and when I finally get to World War I in the book, is talk about all the parades and the way in which women now are patriotic citizens who invade public space, but do so in the name of supporting the war. And so they're in a position to break down some of the barriers that had constrained them before the war.
And yet not all women marched in favor of the war. As you described, quite a few women came out against the war.
Exactly. There are both. There's a pacifist movement before the war, and there's a major peace parade that's quite significant. That's a women's parade. Once the war starts, you do not see public, very many public displays against the war, because there's a lot of repression of free speech during World War I. And so it's pretty dangerous to be marching against the war. But you do see African-American women participating in a historic march to protest racial violence, the riot in East St. Louis that took place in 1917. And you also see a wing of the suffrage movement not parading but picketing the White House, trying to put political pressure on Wilson to come out in support of the suffrage movement. Am I being clear about all these little things? There are a lot of different pieces of this story. I hope I'm making myself clear.
Oh, very much so. I like the fact that you're describing these little pieces, because when I was reading it, I thought that was really interesting how in some ways, the first part of war that these women were engaged in is sort of, on a political level, is this war within the women's movement itself, how you have these women who up until this point are sort of broadly agreed on this, on these political goals or this political agenda. And now they're at odds with each other. And there is a fragmentation that you chart in the book.
Exactly. And I think it's a good reminder for people interested in women's history generally to not romanticize the past, that we're all sisters together. There are a lot of things that divide women: class, ideology, race, ethnicity. And in this case, they're sort of the sense is on the part of women who are part of the Alice Paul's National Woman's Party, which is the one that's picketing the White House. They feel that to beg for the vote, to march for the vote, to try to earn the vote is insulting, that they want to demand the vote. And so they're a much, much more aggressive in their attitude towards promoting suffrage. Whereas the women associated with the nationalists, now I always, it's NASA, and I always have to look at my my cheat sheet to get the exact pronunciation right for you. Hold on a second, I'll do it for you. The National American Woman Suffrage Association. And this was led by Carrie Chapman Catt. And that organization seizes upon the war as a perfect time for women to prove their citizenship. So they're engaged in supporting the war in lots of ways and publicizing their support for the war in order to convince Wilson, but also various male politicians to ultimately vote for suffrage for women.
I took it in one sense, it was a reflection of the maturity of the women's political movement that you could have that degree of gradation and differences. It wasn't a sense of women who may have opposed the war subordinating that and saying, well, we have to go along with this. Instead, they're perfectly willing to say that, you know, this is part of it. They're very advanced in their thinking of not just this their goal, but the implications of what it means to be a fully participating citizen of the Republic.
That's a very good point. I like that. Thank you. I wish I said it. There's a lot of very smart politicking taking place on the part of women in both wings of this organization, of the suffrage movement. And I find them interesting. And I must say that before I started working on the book, I wasn't as interested in the suffrage movement as I became after reading all the very good historical literature that's been written on the suffrage movement. It's a very well-mined field. So what I was doing was pulling together ideas and, you know, doing a little original research, but I really built upon a pretty impressive array of scholarship to be able to do it.
Though politics does loom large in your book, the bulk of it is actually focused more upon how women engage with war more directly, more of on a social level, more on a participatory level. And you start by describing this dimension of volunteerism. I was wondering if you could explain a bit, the women who volunteer and what they were volunteering to do.
Okay. Well, I'm going to indulge myself by telling you a little bit about why I'm so interested in voluntary associations. My first book was on the Freemasons, and almost all of my work tends to have some little piece that's interested in the way in which citizens turn to voluntary associations for a voice, for power, and also the way in which in the United States there's tended to be a very strong link between voluntary associations and political policy. So, for example, all of the combatant nations during World War I used voluntary associations to raise funds, to disseminate propaganda, to drum up support for the war in general. So in some ways, when you look at the way in which women citizens are so engaged in these voluntary associations, it's really a part of what makes war very modern, these World War I and World War II as well. And so you find a wide range of voluntary associations on the part of women, many of which existed before the war, who turned their voluntary associations to various activities, such as helping to organize in the YWCA, for example, helping to create recreational facilities for defense workers, women defense workers, which will promote the industry itself and make sure that the United States is able to get its munitions made, but also will protect working class women from exploitative labor. So you have the group which is interested in protecting working women do that, but also at the same time, they're helping to support the war effort.
You describe it as a reflection of the very modern war they were in. And yet you also make the point in that chapter that it was done along these very traditional lines. It's there in the title. We talk about how it's maternalism and yeah. World War I mobilization in terms of how that defined the level and the extent of their volunteerism.
Yes. When I mentioned the progressive era, reform era, women involved in that were engaged in promoting reforms that historians call maternalist, meaning they sort of justify their engagement in the political arena by saying, as women, whether we're mothers or not, we're in a particularly important position to enter the political arena on behalf of the protection of the home, particularly women and children. And so the legislation that had been passed before World War I, a lot of it dealt with those issues. And so during World War I, the voluntary associations of women, including the Women's Council of National Defense, which is a quasi-governmental agency, all of these organizations are very much engaged in continuing this conversation about protecting women and children. And so they're doing things that are very much engaged in the political realm, yet they're justifying it in part as an extension of maternal values.
Which also serves as a way, in some respects, of limiting the scope of it.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So, for example, although this is really a part of my chapter on the women who were actually working during the war, but the maternal reformers were so worried about these women being exploited that they often talked about them in ways that made them seem very dependent, very vulnerable. Instead of being, hardworking women earning their own living, they would talk about them as the mothers of the race. We have to make sure that we protect their bodies so that they'll be good mothers in the future. And that does tend to emphasize that women are secondary workers. They're not, that's not their first job. So you're absolutely right. There's a quality that limits them when they use this kind of rhetoric.
And yet one of the things that comes across in your book is how there were women who chafed against that limitation and who really pushed back against it in some very dramatic ways. And I'm thinking in particular the women you describe who did this thing that was so unusual where they cross the Atlantic Ocean and they go and they serve the cause in France, not necessarily directly at the front lines, but given the nature of the war, they're in Paris, they're there close to the front lines, and they're really seeking a degree of involvement that is really quite daring, given the assumptions about women that even many members of the women's movement had.
Yeah, I find that group of women quite, as you say, quite fascinating. And it's a kind of range of women because there are people who are sort of relatively wealthy, who've spent their time in Europe before and want to go and continue to sort of participate in refugee efforts. But there are also women who work for American organizations, essentially as social workers, who are already professional women who go abroad in order to particularly to deal with the refugee crisis, but also once the United States has troops there, to be in some way support staff for the troops. They're both nurses, but they're also what were called canteen workers, and these were mostly young women who went under the auspices of the Young Men's Christian Association to provide moral support for the troops by opening little canteens and having making chocolate and being a sort of voice from home. Their perception of themselves was very much as new women out there to being, you know, close to the line, being part of the big show. And their letters just teem with their excitement about being there. And the government, however, was willing to let women do this job of being these canteen workers, because the argument was that having respectable young women near the front would encourage men to be sexually restrained and not visit prostitutes, which was, you know, nonsense. But it was a very much a sort of a very traditional notion about women's proper place, even though they're not in a very proper place. But the women themselves, I would argue, are very uninterested in that, and that very old fashioned notion of what they were up to.
That's one of the things that, as I was reading, I was thinking about more modern debates that we've had about women in the military. And you describe how these women, generally being, middle, upper class, and how they are socializing with these men. And as you describe, it's very proper in a lot of ways, and that there doesn't seem to be a lot of incidents where that. We have come to, unfortunately, associate with women in that type of environment.
And that's, you raise an interesting question. It was a frustrating one for me as a writer, because it's certainly the case that in both in the secondary literature I looked at, as well as my own research, no one's talking about sexual assault. No one's talking about it being afraid of sexual assault. It doesn't mean it didn't happen. You know, as we know, the fact that it wasn't reported doesn't mean that it didn't happen. However, these women were relatively closely chaperoned, and I think there was a lot of concern to make sure that they were safe. And so I believe that I'm right in arguing that it was a much different era than what women might experience in the military now. But in terms of discrimination against them about just because they're women, they're not taking them seriously, that's certainly a constant, I would argue, in the women connected to the military. Women, except for nurses, were not actually in the military during World War I. They were at home, but not abroad. And nurses were not given rank. They were not, they didn't have the privilege that nurses would have by World War II of being officers. So that, again, was a statement of them not being quite viewed as legitimate by the military. The phone operators who went and who were absolutely essential to getting the war working, right? They were members of the Signal Corps. They were given Signal Corps uniforms, and yet they found out after the war they had not been in the Signal Corps. They were civilian employees and not entitled to any benefits. So again, women who are excited about what they're doing, they're engaged in the war, and yet the perception of them is very much as secondary figures in the prosecution of war.
And then you can add another level of discrimination to that.
Yes.
When you talk about the African-Americans who,
yes,
the very small group of African-American women who went abroad to help with the African-American troops that had been deployed, and how on top of all the problems that women face, they face those problems as well.
It's really extraordinary. There were a handful of them, and really, I think, three who ultimately served with the YMCA in very the men were segregated, the women were segregated, and the discrimination that they faced was really quite extraordinary. Two of the women who went abroad wrote a quite extraordinary memoir, which is available even online, I think. One of the authors is Addie Hunton. And it really is a very moving testimony to their desire to be race women, to help to help the soldiers, to promote them. And both of them are much more militant as civil rights activists after the war than they had been before because of their experiences.
For most African-American women, though, this is true, of course, for most women in general, their participation in the war was primarily on the home front. And you describe the really impressive range of activities that they were being called upon to perform, the roles they were being called upon to perform in the workforce during the war because of the call up of so many men to train and fight in France.
Yes. Yes. And so we've been talking about women's engagement in the war primarily in terms of voluntary associations. But once you get into women who went abroad, many of them are working women, are nurses, telephone operators. But as you mentioned, there's an extraordinary opening of opportunities during the war because not only do men go off to war, but immigration is shut off during the war because of the European immigration, because of the Atlantic being such a dangerous place. And these soldiers are these men who would normally have been coming were, you know, involved in their own wars in their own home countries. So the opportunity is quite extraordinary. But what is really interesting is that the participation in the workforce doesn't dramatically increase during the war. What happens is that working class women who would work anyway have new jobs. They have jobs that were viewed as men's jobs. And so for a period of time, women really challenge the barriers that kept them out of skilled work, that kept them out of working, for example, in banks as clerks. That was an all-male type of workplace before World War I. And now you find reports in little towns about the banks being invaded by, you know, women clerks during World War I. So it's not new women workers, but rather having more interesting jobs, higher status, better pay during the war. And they are really... it's really a big deal in the media. There's a lot of attention to it. Lots of pictures of these women, lots of discussions about the way in which women are really transforming the workplace. It's a very exciting time for them, I would argue.
You describe it not just in terms of the roles that they perform, but also how it really did open up all these opportunities. It, particularly when it comes to pay, they were maybe not getting paid as much as men, but they were getting paid far more in these new occupations, these new jobs, than they had been in the more traditional ones they might have performed, such as serving as domestics.
Well, this is that's absolutely right. And that's an important part of this process about opening up new jobs is that the World War I stimulates the first great migration of African Americans. From the South to the cities of the South and of the North and Midwest. And it's an extraordinary opportunity because African Americans, both men and women, had really been denied access to factory jobs, which, although you and I might not think it'd be great to work on the killing floor of a packing house, you could make a lot more money doing that than, you know, being on a farm. For African American women, this is a real opportunity to get out of agricultural labor, to get out of the kitchen and into better jobs. And so that's very exciting for them. And then there's also other opportunities that Black women didn't get. So, for example, streetcar conductors increasingly were women in this era, and it was very contested. In a lot of the cities, men went on strike to try to keep companies from employing women. But the women themselves said, look, we need this work. We're good workers. We should have the right to be conductors. And so there's a lot of interesting source material about the fights between men and women over the right of women to be conductors in this era.
The part of your book in which that intersection of race and work takes place that I thought was most interesting, though, was when you describe the inverse, which is these white women who were going to work on farms. And it's fascinating, because especially when it comes to the South, because women, as you describe, did work in the fields, but they tended to be black. And now you had this situation where you had these white women who, as part of the war effort, were going to work in the fields, and how that was very much flew in the face of a lot of the stereotypes that had been perpetuated by race about the role of men and women who were white versus the ones who were black.
Yeah. This is through primarily through an organization called the Women's Land Army, which was a voluntary association of women who were determined that organizing groups of women to raise crops would both help the war effort and also be a kind of statement about women's ability to do different kinds of work. And many of these women assumed that women could learn to be farm managers, that it wasn't just being agricultural laborers, that there was a kind of career option here. So for the most part, these women, land army women, would go out in groups and live separately among themselves, with someone, you know, doing their own cooking and whatever, and then be detailed to work with farmers, and the rates were negotiated to make sure that they were paid adequately and not exploited because they were women, and not driving down men's wages for when men returned. And one of the arguments is that this way, if you have women in the rural areas, they won't be threatening the farm wife, so they're not living with the family. But these women, for the most part, were not working class women. They tended to be women who had their summers off, teachers, college students, and the like, who viewed this as an opportunity to serve their country, but also do something kind of interesting and earn a little money. The Southern piece is slightly different. The Women's Land Army is not as successful in the South as it is elsewhere. And I would argue it's because of race, because of the anxiety about what it means to have white women in the fields. And so some of the newspaper reportage of white women working in the fields really makes a big point of talking about how they're protected, how they go home at night. They're, you know, it's nothing that's really going to too much damage their femininity or expose them to unwanted contact with African Americans.
One area where you literally don't see any African Americans, though, is in how the media portrayed women involved with the war. And yes, you spend a considerable amount of time talking about the various media in which women are depicted. You talk about magazine covers. You talk about how they're portrayed in film. And it really is a very interesting venue in which you're seeing how these roles are being sorted and presented for a wider audience.
Yes. That's probably my favorite part of the book. It's the last chapter, so you have to wade through everything to get to it. But it's a chapter on the, you know, popular culture representations. And getting back to the way your segue into this about race, I think it's a really important piece of the puzzle, because mainstream media, federal government propaganda assumes women are white. There's absolute invisibility of women of color. But I should point out that the archives of, for example, the Women's Bureau do have very interesting images, photographs of black women working, of Japanese American women in the Red Cross. But it's not for public consumption. So historians can use it. But at the time, other women were pretty invisible. And I think that's something to stress. So the image of this new woman who emerges very clearly in the media during the war is of a white woman. It's a young woman. And the way in which the media presents these new women is to show them in parades, in military uniforms. There's a lot of depictions of women wearing pants or wearing uniforms of some kind or another. This is both the voluntary associations like the YWCA, but also working women who are working in factories. So I was absolutely struck by the sort of pervasive sense of excitement about these images of women who are, you know, really crossing gender barriers by taking on these new jobs. At the same time, propaganda posters that put out by the federal government show women in very traditional mode, as in their kitchens conserving food, or as grandmothers urging you to buy war bonds. So there's a real sense of disjuncture between how the federal government is talking, visualizing women, and how other agencies are. My favorite example of this is there's one poster that the U.S. government put out, the U.S. Employment Agency, that features a working woman. It's a secretary dressed in a little black skirt and a white shirt, and she's at her desk. But in the background, you can see the threatening German. So she's really ready to, as a typist, to do her job for the military. But the YWCA poster that features women shows a huge group of women marching in very masculine looking clothes, carrying things like sledgehammers and wrenches. And it's a completely different image. It's one that's really shocking to the senses when you realize when you juxtapose the sort of neat little typist with the women carrying their wrenches. So there's a lot of tension in the representation, visual representation, in print media and in propaganda posters about this new woman.
Yeah, I was thinking about how those contrasted with the more traditional portrayals of women being ravaged by the Hun. You have in one page reproduced the poster of not a German soldier, but an ape with a club with Kultur on it. And there the woman is sort of like a precursor of Fay Wray in King Kong. She's at the mercy of the big ape who is threatening not just culture, but, you know, virtuous womanhood, and how men are basically being told you need to step up and save her. So it's not, as you described, it's not a total new portrayal, but there is a lot of that traditional element that oftentimes it coexists with these posters and this imagery, which sees women as very empowered.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked me that, because it's one of my favorite pieces of that chapter. When I started looking at these posters and also looking at films about that feature women in war, I was struck by how pervasive the rape motif was, that women were in danger from the German rapist, and men needed to, you know, step up to the plate and save women from what was literally a fate worse than death. And the thing that I found very interesting about this is that as I was doing the research for it and the reading in the history of film and also theater, the rape motif was pretty significant piece in popular culture in the early 20th century before the war. There's a lot of attention to the dangers that women face from unscrupulous men. Many people have seen the sort of dreadful Birth of a Nation film, the racist depiction of Reconstruction. And that, you know, an important subplot of that is the rape of the white woman by the black man. And so what I argue in talking about the rape motif in film and imagery during World War I is that Americans were sort of primed to think about women's vulnerability and to sort of associate danger with a racial or an ethnic other. And so that it makes perfect sense that you'd see so much of this rape content in the World War I imagery, and particularly in the films. So you have that as a really important piece that suggests how conventional and Victorian in many ways the visions of women were. But on the other hand, in films, you have women who are heroines, who are spies, who are doing all sorts of extraordinary, daring-do feats to to be participants in the war effort. And so that it's a split, as in many of the chapters, traditional expectations coming up against a completely different notion of women being heroines.
As you describe in many of these films, including the one that you say we have extant, Wolf of the Culture, that even when the woman is engaged in very daring, very masculine activities, such as very physical activities, even to the point where she's able to knock out the enemy and save the day, it ends with her being sort of placed back in her feminine role through marriage. And the one where that really stands out that I thought was really funny was the movie you described that came out soon after the war, where the women are, where the men come home and the women have assumed all these occupations at home. They're in charge of the government. They're in charge all over the place. And it's almost as if it's saying, you know, that women, sort of reflecting that undercurrent of fear that is also in these other things, that women may be getting a little too independent and capable.
Yes, that's called. Oh, the film was called "Oh, You Women," and it's not extant. So, but I read the script was available, and I looked at a lot of imagery, and it's really quite extraordinary because it centers in some ways around women's clothing, because for comedic effect during the war, all the women start wearing pants. And when they come, when the men, and they're the mayors and they're taking over all the offices, and when the men come back, the women don't want to put on dresses again. And so there's this real real way of using the sort of cross-dressing issue, which comes out repeatedly in the films and in the media, using that to stand for the threat that the war produces, the notion that it might really upend the gender order by giving women too much power and wearing the pants in the family, so to speak.
And yet, one of the most telling aspects of that whole movie, for me, was that it was co-written by a woman, Anita Loos.
Yes. Anita Loos, who I think that's how we pronounce her name. And she's the one who did the original Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
So to what degree did those concerns sort of foreshadow what happens to women after the war? How did the war change their lives, and how did the war not change their lives in essence?
I would have loved to have found that the war was transformative, because I think, you know, it makes for an easier way to explain the book rather than the sort of nuanced argument that I end up making. One of the things that I think is really important to note is that this challenge in the workplace for women to have access to better jobs, higher skilled jobs, to quote men's jobs, to break down sex segregated labor, disappears completely after the war. They return to women's jobs. Clerical work may have expanded during the war, but other than that, it is pretty much back to business as usual. And this includes the experiences of African-American women who end up returning to agricultural and farm labor. So, you know, not much happens in the realm of work. That's pretty clear. Certainly, one could argue that the war promoted the suffrage movement. I think it definitely accelerated the passage of the amendment that enfranchised women. But it didn't cause it. It was the momentum was there. It speeded it up. And then we have to argue, well, you know, women got the vote, but lots of women couldn't vote because they were Black women in the South. And also women weren't really able to turn having the vote to much political power. They weren't able to use it, for example, to improve women's access to the workplace. So there's some change that the war promotes, but not necessarily causes. The thing that I found most interesting about the change has to do with the sort of physical freedoms that women had. And this returns us to the women that you found so interesting, those women who went abroad, right, and were doing such dramatic things. or the women who are marching, who are wearing new clothes and finding a kind of new physical freedom. So I think there was a kind of sense of a breakdown of notions about conventional personal behavior, the sort of restraint of respectability that had been so much a part of the 19th century, I do think really is put given a sort of redirection as a result of much of the war activity and the sort of opportunities that women had, however short, to really challenge gender conventions.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before you go, would you tell us what you're working on now?
Yes. I have a bunch of little projects, but and I'm really looking forward to a number of opportunities to go talk about the book. As I told you before we started, I'm off to the University of Texas, Rio Grande next week to talk about the book. But I also decided that I wasn't quite willing to give up war and women yet. And, so I decided to do a document, book, a collection of documents for the classroom on working women during World War II to see, you know, how to sort of build upon the expertise I developed for this book to try to sort out what happened during World War II. Because for one thing, the same thing happens after World War II. Women do lose some of the access to the good jobs they had during the war. So that's my major project. And I'm really, really enjoying finding interesting documents to put together in a collection.
That sounds like a fascinating project.
It is. It's great. I just got permission today from an oral history archive to use some material that hasn't been published before of two women who were active in unions during the war, one an African-American woman, and another a woman who later became very active in the feminist movement after World War II.
Wow.
Yeah, it's good.
Well, best of luck with the project.
Thank you.
Lynn, thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thanks. Thanks very much.